John Aston, number 11, and Knowles watching him. Kidd looking for that one, and Law! There it is by Dennis Law! Well, would you believe it? For 30 minutes, they are outclassed, and then in a flash, Law puts Manchester United in front. What an astonishing turnabout, but what a superb piece of opportunism by Dennis Law.
Hello and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley, and as ever, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
And Terry DeFallon.
Hello.
A bit quiet today, aren't we? We're recovering a bit because we've had a busy weekend, haven't we, on the podcast? Because myself, Jan and Terry, we were out of the country. Ish. Sort of ish out of the country. We went to Jersey for the weekend, didn't we, lads?
We did. We went for the weekend, but it felt we were there for about a month, in a good way.
In a good way, yeah. Yeah, that's what happens when you get up at 5 a.m. on a Saturday, because it really does give you the whole day ahead, doesn't it? And it's not because we're hungover as well. Well, Terry and I maybe a little bit, but Jan's doing dry January, so he's got no excuse. But yeah, it was a full-on weekend, wasn't it?
It was a full-on weekend. It was terrific. Yeah, it started at 4:45 in the morning. With a walk up the hill to get a lift to Gatwick, and finished with the rail replacement bus service driver getting lost and having to do a 51-point turn to turn his bus around.
Oh, dear.
Like on Austin Powers.
On Austin Powers, exactly. Yeah, he was driving along, minding his own business, and suddenly the road was closed, and he went, ah. So no one had obviously told him about the other traffic development. So, yeah. And that, but that's still, I got back at the time. I had a chance to sit and watch SAS Rogue Heroes and then go to bed. Up for work, fresh as a daisy, after a satisfying and restful couple of days in good company and in good surroundings.
Yes, and yeah, a win as well for Whiteleaf.
Fantastic win. So Whiteleaf beat Jersey Bulls 1-0 in a game that was as long as the Old Testament. I mean, it was quite literally, I'm going to use that metaphor again, biblical in its length. So the game kicked off at 4 o'clock, didn't it? And yeah. It finished at about 6:15?
About that, yeah, yeah.
I think they said there was 12 minutes of added time at the end, but it felt like a lot more than that. And the reason, listeners, that it felt like a lot more than that is because Whiteleaf were defending a very slim 1-0 lead against a very good Jersey side. Who had the best part of 1,000 fans cheering them on. Most of those were children, though. Yeah, so it made it feel like it lasted forever, but in the bitter, and it was bitterly cold, Jersey evening, Whiteleaf held on and got a famous win. And like I said, Jersey are no slouches. They're a great side, and we did well, very, very well. And there was much partying and jumping around and banging of signs and hugging of players to be had. It was a wonderful time to be alive.
Well, listeners, if you're not across the current league table of the Combined Counties South Division, it kept Whiteleaf top on goal difference ahead of Redhill, and it inflicted Jersey's first league defeat of the season. So, yeah, big, big news all the way round, isn't it, Terry?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, just to emphasise, it was Wagnerian in its length. I mean, really. If it was to be released on CDs, it would be an entire box set. It was just absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, nice little stadium, actually. Or should I say little? They got a little municipal stadium there with a nice, healthy-looking grandstand. But the entertainment they put on is quite nice. It felt sort of like a German visit, a German Regionalliga or Oberliga visit. You know, it had a DJ, it had some hot dogs, it had some outdoor beers. And the DJ clearly knew his audience. He was there with his Chemical Brothers shirt, and he was knocking out the 90s and 80s bangers, and we were all having a wonderful time.
We were.
And it was really nice. The only downer was sad that you couldn't bring your beer into the ground, which is a bit of a shame, but let's not get too hung up on stuff like that. So they made us feel very welcome, and it was a terrific result. And I was standing behind the goal, and literally, if the net hadn't have been there, the ball would have hit my face. That's the view that I had of the goal as it went in. I don't actually remember the goal being scored. I only remember the ball bulging the net right in front of my eyes.
That's when recency bias just takes over. That's all it is. All you can remember is the ball in the net. Good job it was on YouTube anyway, wasn't it? So we got to see the goal again and again and again and again and again. Oh,
yeah. I've not seen that yet. So is there a picture of me going, yeah, and us going, yeah, because we were literally standing around a goal. Are we in shock? Can we be seen? Are we YouTube famous now?
I've only watched it on my phone. So I'm sure if you zoom in on a bigger screen, get the projector out, Terry, and have a look and see if you can point yourself out on there.
An actual reaction shot on YouTube. How about that? You don't see many of them, do you?
No. yes. So... yeah, I'm just for the record, listeners, Terry is doing a YouTube reaction shot right now. But there was loads of other football as well. Lots of big games, lots of goals. I think all the games in the box set last weekend had a heap of goals. Like, there was like 4-2s, 3-2s. Not so much in the Friday night game was there, but there could have been more goals if Sunderland had actually put a couple of penalties away, couldn't they, Jan?
Yes, they could have. So Sunderland got two penalties, one of which wasn't a penalty, but in the Championship, we are not held back by VAR. So I thought we'd get away without using VAR in this one, but there you go. Yeah, the first penalty was given, the foul was outside of the box. The second penalty was given, and the foul was inside of the box. But in both cases, Wilson Isidore, who's Sunderland's striker, missed both, well, rather the goalkeeper, James Trafford, saved both of them. After and over two penalties, 5 minutes of what has to be said as world-class shithousery. And to be fair, Wilson Isidore and the Sunderland team should have just picked up the ball and gotten sat on the centre spot or something and waited for him to change his gloves like he did in the for the first penalty and mysteriously got a knock when he was nowhere near the incident that led to the second penalty. Should have just got off and took stock and then stepped up when they were nice and fresh for the penalty, but they didn't. They stood there and watched James Trafford take the piss out of them and the referee, and he only got booked for it, and that was it. But fair play to him. If that was me, I would use all means at my disposal to put off the striker. And he certainly did. So it ended 0-0. So with my Sunderland hat on, while I'm devastated that we didn't manage to take advantage of the blessings that were bestowed on us, I'm still pleased with a point at Burnley because they're a cracking side and that they are really good and they deserve to be where they are. So that's a point earned, I think, really.
Yeah, Terry, we watched those penalties. It's easy enough to say now, isn't it? But really, I mean, what was the guy doing taking that second one? His first penalty was so awful, wasn't it? At least you could say, well, it was a bonus one because it was a shocking decision. But the fact that he steps up and takes another one, and it's even worse than the first one.
Yeah, he's got to try and put it somewhere else. I mean,
yeah, in the goal.
For a start. Yeah, I mean, actually somewhere else. I mean, somewhere else within the, the goal. James Trafford, yeah, absolute world class. And I mean, you don't want to be victim blaming here to an extent, but really the game is mature enough, I think, at this point where perhaps the Sunderland players, could have gone, yeah, you know what, let's just like back away from this. Let's walk away from this. Because there's always mind games going on in the build up to penalties now. And there's, ways of combating that. And I don't want to seem unkind because Isidore was clearly devastated at the end of the game and I felt very, very sorry for him.
Yeah.
And no, in fairness, you don't necessarily put it on the player. I think maybe there's some coaching required here. Just so let's say, right, lads, if the goalkeeper starts acting up, then pick up the ball, walk up to the halfway line, get away, move away, clear your mind, let them get on with it. If they want to take 5 minutes or whatever, 2 minutes to change their gloves and the referee's happy with it, then that's fine. And then you come back with a fresh mind. It's easier said than done, of course. The other thing, is modern penalty takers, they've got more than one way to take a penalty. Hopefully, he'll obviously bounce back from the experience. He won't let it traumatise him. But maybe that means it's an opportunity for him to, finesse his technique and his repertoire from the 12-yard. If he's being asked to take penalties, then he probably needs to finesse his repertoire. Finesse his repertoire? Did I just say that?
Yeah. And I think everyone did. Will be saying it next week. I'm sure of it. You can finesse your own repertoire as well. And who knows what we'll be talking about next week. All right, that one finished 0-0. But there were plenty of goals in other games that we put in the box set. I'm looking down the list now. I've got a 4-1, a 2-2, 3-2, another 3-2, and a 4-2. Goals were just raining in, and especially at St. James's Park. Now, this is the one game on here that I watched the entirety of, and my word, one of the games of the season. A great ding-dong battle. Bournemouth. And like we were complaining about getting up at 5 o'clock. The Bournemouth fans were getting up at 2 o'clock to try and get to St. James's Park for 12:30. Now, Jan, I suppose you enjoyed that one quite a lot, didn't you? Well, I know. I was sat next to you.
I enjoyed it very much. I suppose slightly bittersweet in that I have three Newcastle players in my fantasy team. And my son, who also joined us, had just taken Justin Clivert out of his team that morning. So he's also a Sunderland supporter. And so he was devastated and elated at the same time as the little guy. But yeah, Justin Clivert, he was wonderful. But Bournemouth were on a different level, weren't they? So Newcastle, just for context, have been on an amazing run of form. And at home, they are imperious. And I thought that Bournemouth were going to, knowing that Bournemouth were a good side, I thought they'd give Newcastle a good goal, but ultimately they would probably lose and probably lose narrowly. But anything but happened. Bournemouth, just every time they came forward, they looked like they had a real sense of purpose. They looked dangerous. The ball was always on the floor. They just, you know, it's not like they battered Newcastle just by chucking balls at them. They outplayed them. And they were better than them, and their finishing was outstanding. It was a great game to watch. Even better and sweeter seeing Newcastle get taken apart. When I was on a holiday in Europe, wonderful.
Terry, Bournemouth haven't had that many plaudits, I think. It's been appreciated how well they're doing. But I think it's always seemed to be this season a bit caveated. It always seems to be that people are saying, well, you know, they haven't had any really landmark results, or they're just performing well while other teams are performing badly. And the same could be true of Forest, I guess. But you can't argue where they are second half of the season. And to put a performance like that in, this is a real statement performance, wasn't it?
It's not Bournemouth's fault that Tottenham are rubbish this season, or that Manchester United are rubbish this season.
Yeah.
And neither of it's Nottingham Forest's fault. The teams that you might expect to be further up the table are not playing well this season. These teams are playing and are getting to where they are completely on merit. And that was thoroughly demonstrated against an in-form, hitherto unbeatable Newcastle side. And to go out there and win so comprehensively. I think that Bournemouth suffer from the fact that they are not a very fashionable team. They're not a big team in terms of the fact they have very little support. And that also that they've not necessarily pushed themselves forward. I don't think they're not a particularly expressive team. I was reading, is it Matt Slater's article in The Athletic this morning about Bill Foley and about the owner's approach that he has. He said, Matt Slater said that he once passed on a compliment to Bill Foley from another sporting director, saying that the sporting director was worried about Bournemouth because they appeared to know what he's doing, to which Bill Foley's response was, I'd rather they didn't think that we knew what we were doing. So I think that there is an understated sort of character to the way Bournemouth are doing things. I think they are trying to get on with things quietly, so in the hope that no one notices. But, you know, that's changing. And, you know, with headline performances like that, it's going to change even more so. And suddenly, when you consider this is that without their two strikers, Unai's injured, Evan Nilsson injured, you know, and those guys have given quite a lot to that side. And then to play like that, and obviously a legendary performance from Justin Clivert, they are definitely there on merit. And given that they had a good season last season, you'd be foolish to think that they'll fall away. I mean, let's not get carried away, but a definite strong top eight finish. I think eighth would be a bit of a disappointment. We'll see how the injuries go.
Well, yeah. If they were to get a European spot this season, it would be well deserved.
Yeah, I agree. I thought, well, I mean, obviously we've talked about how good they were in that particular game, but across the whole season, I mean, you don't get to be seventh at this stage by being rubbish, do you? Yeah, they're in for a shout of Europe without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, they peg Newcastle right back to within a point of them, and Newcastle are in fifth, so they've got every chance of making that happen. It's good for competition within the Premier League as well, because you've got teams like, I mean, Forest, clearly the most impressive of the bunch, but you've got Bournemouth, you've got Brighton, you've got Fulham and Brentford, all really, really strong teams that make up the bulk of the top half, that are sides that you just wouldn't want to play against, even if you've had a team of winners. It's really good for the Premier League, making it, opening it up, and we're not just suffering from the kind of monopoly that we've seen in recent years.
Yeah, and they haven't lost since November. They're on a Premier League unbeaten run of 10 games. Over the last 10 games, they've earned as many points as Liverpool.
Yeah, that makes them one of the best teams in the Premier League, right? So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's dangerous to analyse these things over a short period of time, but when it fits into your narrative, it's absolutely fine.
And they've got Forest at home next. That's a real test for them, but they can go into that with real confidence, thinking, well, as you said, Graham, they haven't lost in a couple of months. They've had some great performances, and they can go into that thinking, well, we could probably pull back Forest as well and bring ourselves. I mean, potentially they could jump into a European spot.
Potentially so.
Bournemouth in Europe.
Yes.
That'd be great. I'd love that.
We're of an age, listeners. I mean, I think actually most people are of an age where Bournemouth in Europe is not something that you would have imagined that you'd see in your lifetime. It's an extraordinary rise. You can speak an awful lot about the money that's been spent, whether or not a club of that size merits the kind of money that's been spent on it. That's a conversation that I think you can have at a different time, because we're literally here to praise Bournemouth and not to criticise them. But there's no arguing with what they've done with the money that they've had. And I would still suggest that even though, yes, they are quite well funded, that they're probably, their budget is not as big as far more illustrious football clubs with bigger support and a lot more money, and have completely made a hash of their situation, where Bournemouth have profited through good management. They know what they're doing.
It's a lot like what's been happening in Germany, isn't it? You look at the second division in Germany, and it's full of teams that are meant to be the big teams. Teams that a decade, 20 years ago, weren't just competing in Europe, they were getting to finals in Europe. And now they're kicking their heels in the second division, while a lot of so-called unfashionable sides are now filling up the top flight, aren't they, Terry?
Yeah, so you got Hamburg and Schalke are two excellent examples of teams that competed in European competition very, very recently. Massive stadiums, massive support, national support as well, and also likely international support. Teams that have got no business whatsoever being second division clubs in any league and in any country. And yet you've also then got up in the league above, you've got Holstein Kiel, who, to be fair, may well be relegated, but who have been promoted for the first time. Tiny club. Heidenheim is another example. Tiny club. And these clubs are making a fist of it. Again, they're not very popular clubs, and they are small clubs, but they are making the best use of their resources. Heidenheim qualified for Europe in their first ever season in the Bundesliga last season. They're having a tougher time of it this season. But yeah, I mean, when you've got clubs like Fortuna Düsseldorf, FC Köln, you know, Kaiserslautern, who won the title in 2001, they've only just managed to bring themselves back into the Bundesliga 2 after, you know, having suffered complete calamity. So yeah, it just goes to show you that, yeah, what can be done with limited resources. It isn't always about the money, although obviously it does help. But you do have to have the right management. And if you have a succession of poor management, then you create a culture of poor management that, as we see in other clubs, is very, very difficult to address. Poor leadership can be endemic, and it feels ethereal from outside, but in fact, it's probably actually process driven. You know, football doesn't have auditors that can go in and say, right, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that needs to be changed, that needs to be changed, because that's just not, football's too chaotic for that. So yeah, it is extraordinary. It's why football is such a wonderful game to watch, but it's why it can also be quite painful to watch, depending on whether or not you're a Hamburg fan.
I suppose there is something to be said, though, in the fact that with teams with good resources that are lightweight, for want of a better word, more agile than bigger clubs, bigger, well-supported clubs, there is that element of the fact that if they want to change something, they can do, and it's something that can be implemented quickly, and if it doesn't work, then it can be changed quickly. What Terry was just saying there, Jan, I mean, it must have rung a few bells with your own club, mustn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Since the change of ownership and since Kyril Lewis-Dreyfus came in and his brother, they've come in with a plan. And it, as you say, Graham, it hasn't always gone according to plan. And so they've had to move and be fleet of foot to make the changes the way they think is the best. So, for example, last season with Beale, clearly a massive mistake. But this season with Labrice, they're doing really, really well. So it's they've made a change and they've gone with it. And you compare that to making a change at somewhere like Manchester United, where you've got an entire hierarchy that is in there for whatever reason, mainly to extract cash from the club, that are quite happy just keeping it as a big name. You're right, that's a bit more like turning an oil tanker around, isn't it? And we've seen them try to make the changes they have. But you're right, Brighton have changed their managers. Forest have also changed their manager in the last few years as well. So, and they're doing really well. So I think you're right, Graham, that's a really good point. Having less baggage, being more forward thinking and being fleet of foot allows you to make the changes and you can continue going forward even when you have, you know, smaller setbacks.
Yeah, obviously we've spoken about Man United a lot over the last few months, over the last few years really, but it was nice to see that Amorim finally came out and admitted that this Man United side is the worst team in history of all time, of all teams, of all leagues. There is no worst team ever to have existed than this Man United side. That's what he said, wasn't it, Terry?
Word for word, that's exactly what he said.
Yeah.
It is kind of what he said, but that's not what he... I don't think he meant it like that. I think he was really talking about himself and his own contribution, and he was talking about what Man United fans might be thinking right now, particularly in respect to him and the fact that he's only been in for a short time, but actually, you know, his record, the record of the club, his record there is not good. And I think he was trying to demonstrate empathy while at the same time, sort of like, you know, rather cheekily, sort of like giving media guys the headline that they wanted to say that this was the worst Man United team in history. And it does appear that the media have got behind that. Even though there's context behind his words. This is not the worst Manchester United team in history.
Context? Nuance? Better luck next time, Ruben. He came within 10 minutes of losing at home to Southampton last week. And yes, Amad Diallo, yes, we can all praise him for scoring a hat-trick. But yeah, within 10 minutes of losing to Southampton, the alarm bells just haven't stopped ringing, have they, at that club? And of course, when you get a bit more of an organised team like Brighton turning up, it's no surprise that they lose 3-1. God, that side knocked Arsenal out of the FA Cup last week. I'm just... Yes. Great. Yeah.
I wonder how long he's going to be in that job. I'm being serious, because, I mean, they've got, coming up on Thursday, they've got a Europa League game against Rangers, and then they've got Fulham on the Saturday away. That's two games that they can quite easily lose, given their form. You know, there's only so many swords you can fall on before, you know, they might make another switch. I mean, you don't know what's going on. It's a bin fire of a club, as we've said before.
And
Radcliffe is a ruthless, ruthless bastard. And if he wants to make a change, he'll make the change.
Well, exactly. I mean, and obviously with the change they made with Dan Ashworth there, they obviously don't mind just deciding that they made a mistake. Is this their approach to being agile and reactive, Terry? Do you think, or do you think this is just poor management?
No, this is classic Tory industrialist sort of like idea of being agile, which just means like, you know, let's just fire and lay people off, and that way we'll seem leaner and fitter. Whereas, in fact, actually, agility requires investment. You spend money if you want to be agile. You just spend it in the right places. But yeah, this is always the biggest trick that guys like Ratcliffe, they always miss, is that they think that agility is associated with cost cutting. And it's classic Tory. Classic Tory. Yeah. It's austerity in a nutshell. It does feel like they've put an awful lot of themselves into Amorim to bring him there. And I think he will get as much time as they can. But it's whether or not they've got the self-control to stick it out with him. I mean, the guy deserves, at the very least, he deserves until the end of the season And really, to be honest, he should be given a full pre-season to be able to really implement his ideas and hopefully have some kind of influence on the kind of players who are going to come in to the club. But do the leadership have the patience and the self-control not to do something impulsive and fire him and get somebody else? And that, I think, is the key. And in a lot of cases with clubs like this, yes, the manager has to take some responsibility for the results. But in terms of the overall direction of travel of a club, that is club leadership, which is above the grade of the manager these days.
Mm-hmm. So, hear me out here. How about...
Here we go.
If Radcliffe phones up Daniel Levy and says, do you fancy a swap?
Oh, mate.
I mean, come on. I mean, both of them aren't going down. They're very low down, but there's enough teams below them that are not going to be able to turn it around. I reckon 32 points is going to be safe this season in the Premier League. I think it's going to be one of those seasons. So, you know, you've got the rest of the season. Why not just say, well, look, it's not working. We know you're really good guys. We know you can do this, but it's obviously not working out where you are. Why don't we just swap jobs? Yeah, and that might work, mightn't it?
Well, it might. I can't see Amarin wanting to go. He's already joined one bin fire of a club. He's probably thinking, I'm just going to go back to Portugal. In fact, I think he'll probably get sacked this season. He'll be rehired at Sporting. He'll get them through into the knockout stages of the Champions League, and he'll win Liga Portugal just to prove that it wasn't anything to do with him. Yeah, he's not going to want to go to Spurs, is he? No, that's not going to happen. But of course, Ange needs to see out the season because, as he said, he always, his words, always wins something in his second season. And he's got the League Cup on, hasn't he? I mean, that's definitely going to happen.
Well, is
it? They're definitely going to beat Liverpool in the second leg.
Yeah, but of course, Tottenham do have form with sacking managers before League Cup finals, don't they, Terry?
Yep, indeed. Yeah, they could. So it doesn't always follow. So he needs to be careful because, yep, Jose Mourinho was fired on the eve of the League Cup final. What an extraordinary decision that was. Absolutely. That must have been some rancor between those two, mustn't there? Good grief. How much have you pissed somebody off that you get fired just before the League Cup final? What a way to shoot yourself in the foot. Ridiculous.
Yeah.
I, for one, don't agree with the Tottenham fans that are shouting Levy out. He's got to stay in there. Not for any other reason. It's just so entertaining. Well, we were talking about this over the weekend, weren't we? If you're looking at the TV listings for the weekend ahead and you see Spurs are on there, yeah, brilliant. Spurs are playing. This is going to be brilliant. It's going to be great because they're either going to batter someone or get battered by someone or nearly embarrass themselves in the FA Cup. It's a wonderful time to be alive, this Spurs side. It really is.
It's the gift that keeps on giving. And yeah, Tottenham fan, this isn't like us ripping on a team that's bad, that's going through a bad spell. Man United are going through a bad spot. Doesn't make them very entertaining to watch. Tottenham are great fun to watch at the moment if you're not invested in them. And yeah, I can appreciate how you don't give a crap about us enjoying ourselves. But there it is. I'm being honest here, okay?
The Arsenal fan speaks.
I mean, I am looking ahead in the TV listings to the weekend. And Sunday at 2 o'clock, it's Tottenham against Leicester.
Well, I mean, how is that going to end? -2, -2 or something like that.
That's just going to be great.
I mean, that's the thing, Terry. Just 4 games ago, Palace were just 3 points above Leicester.
Mm.
And now Palace are genuine mid-table and Leicester are second from bottom. That's how quick things are changing down there. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong about saying, oh, well, Tottenham and Man U are safe, because if Wolves get their mojo back, we don't know what they're going to do tonight. They're playing Chelsea tonight, and Chelsea need a win from somewhere as well. They're not going through a great period at the moment, ever since we said genuine title contenders.
Sound of football, kiss of death. Yeah. Yes, mwah. Love it.
So, oh God, yeah, and I've just said that Man United and Tottenham, they're definitely safe. Whoa.
Oh my God, Graham, what have you done?
Yeah, so sorry about that. Yeah, stay tuned for the rest of the season, because who knows what's going to happen there, really. What would you think of Ange as a Man United manager, though, Terry?
I mean, you'd love to see it for much the same reasons as to why you'd love to see him, love it at Spurs. If there's a serious aspect to that question, I think the way in which Ange plays, I'm not certain that there's a team in England that's really suited for that style of play. And I think that a lot of that is because I think that that's just not how English football is. I hate to say it because I don't wish to denigrate his previous achievements, but at Celtic, the team and the players, the squad there were, I would suggest, so far superior.
Yeah.
That you could play within reason, any kind of reasonable formation and tactics and strategy, and still get results. And I'm not a close follower of Scottish football, so I will caveat my remarks by saying that I may have got that wrong, but I don't want to be that guy who says, oh, well, you know, Scottish league's rubbish and the Premier League's a proper league. And, you know, but the fact is that the Premier League is a very, very competitive league with a lot of very good players and coaches who are able to adjust and cope with all kinds of different strategies and approaches to play, which, you know, maybe in the rest of his career, he's not quite encountered. And again, I realize that sounds condescending, but I don't mean it to be. But it does appear to be bearing out. The way he plays is, you know, is ridiculously high line. The midfield, absence of the defensive midfielder, the fullbacks are just name only. It's a wonderful way to watch football, but there isn't any kind of balance or pragmatism. And I think you do genuinely need that. And I fear it will cost him his job. And so were he to go to Manchester United, I think he would just do the same again. I think it just depends. I mean, if it was a question of, I don't know, if someone was to come along even and say, look, okay, Angela, we're going to play it your way. Tell me the players you need to do this, and we're going to sign all those players in the summer, and you're going to get them. We'll get them in the January window, and then we'll get the rest of them in the summer window. You'll have the preseason with them, and this is it, and then we'll go. And then maybe it might work. But I think the issue, the problem is that when you're inheriting squads, as you always do, irrespective of whether you've had preseason or not, he's asking them to do something that I think players at the Premier League level tend not to do. And I think that that's, in essence, the problem with Ange Ball. It's wonderful. And for the record, I do hope he succeeds, because I do think he's a really, really good coach and a good guy. And I like to see guys like that succeed. But, I mean, at the moment, nah, mate.
As well, when things start going wrong, everything gets blamed on the system, doesn't it? Even the injuries, because they are going through a massive injury crisis at the moment, Tottenham. But what happens in these situations is when the team isn't doing well and there's an injury crisis, people will look at that and say, well, is this anything to do with the style of play? Because it seems to be in defence where most of the injuries are happening. When you've got this defence that is on the edge, playing cup finals every week, is it any surprise that the defenders are dropping like flies? That is obviously an oversimplistic way of looking at it. And yeah, I'm sure anyone listening to me could easily hammer in me and completely take that out of context. But there may be some truth in that. I always think, though, that when your team's not playing well or results aren't going your way, injuries just seem to come at you more readily. Players in a losing mindset or in a losing team somehow just pick up injuries a lot more than players at teams that are just riding on the crest of a wave.
What you're saying is Ange Ball injures players. Well, yeah, I get that completely. Yeah, that's what you said. Yeah, Ange Ball injures players. Yeah, that's what you said.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely what I said, wasn't it?
but you know, when things like that happen, also there's you should expect the coach to adjust the tactics accordingly based on and manage the squad and say, well, look, all of my guys who can play this way, they're not fit, so I have to play a different way. Again, we're all being very simplistic, and it is difficult. And you know, he's a 59-year-old, ridiculously experienced coach. He's managed all over the world. He's picked up trophies all over the world. He's forgotten more about football than I ever knew. But, you know, we're a podcast. We get to express opinions. And you just have to look and see what's happening. And that is what's happening. They play ridiculous football. It's very entertaining, but they lose matches against teams they should beat. Yeah, I don't know how much of that you could put on the ownership, if I'm being honest with you.
Mm.
No, I agree with that. And as well as that, he said, and he's had these questions put to him by the press, he said, look, I'm just not going to change. So,
nah, mate.
So it does suggest that maybe there's a lack of flexibility there. It's his way or the highway. And if his team picks up injuries along the way, then so be it. Again, as you say, massively oversimplifying that. What he says to the press is not necessarily what he says to the players. It could well be that, you know, he's just been really unlucky. In fact, it probably is, because you don't have a career like he's had and then just suddenly hit a brick wall here. And maybe it is to do with the club.
Well, I'm not going to put that Tottenham-Leicester game into the box set this week.
No, I might.
Okay, I could put it in there, but I just thought people are going to watch it anyway. We don't need to big it up. Fine, they're going to tune into it. I'm going to be putting St. Pauli versus Union for a bit of German action on Sunday afternoon, because that's the way we roll, isn't it, Terry?
That is the way we roll. And St. Pauli versus Union is an intriguing game. Obviously, two narratives about both of those two. But yeah, there are interesting points. St. Pauli struggling, yeah, newly promoted, trying to stay up. Looking much better value these days. Union Berlin have had a coaching change. Stefan Baumgart is back in the Bundesliga, and this is a reason to be happy. And they won their first game at the weekend under him. I think that we're in for some hijinks and a good atmosphere, a good backdrop there for what will be a tense game as we now start to think about the business end of the season, Graham.
Business end of the season. He said it first. He said it in January, before even the January window shut, business end of the season.
I think that's when the business... We start to think about the business end of the season.
Oh, of course he says,
don't misquote me. Don't take my remarks out of context.
We're still in the...
That's my job.
Actually, we are actually in the business part of the season, because this is the only part of the season when you can actually buy and sell players. So technically, this is the literal business area of the season. Yeah. Can't take that out of context.
Can't argue with that logic.
No, you can't.
I cannot argue with that logic. So I won't.
And Jan, I suppose City's recovery is going to move on Saturday as they take on Chelsea. Easy home win, I suppose, in the state Chelsea are in at the moment.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, Chelsea are going to be playing just after we finish recording. So, it looks like City have forgotten their huge blip that they had, which was always going to happen, wasn't it? And Chelsea aren't, I don't want to say they're not doing so well, because they could well win handsomely tonight. Regardless, that is a great one to watch. And I'm sure there'll be some entertainment going on there.
Yes, and there'll be other stuff as well. We've got Sheffield United versus Hull on Friday night, Lazio Fiorentina on Sunday night, and some WSL action with Chelsea and Arsenal, top two in the WSL, facing each other on Sunday lunchtime. And if you want to see what we think about those games, then get along to sofpodcast.com and subscribe to the Weekend Box Set. And it will be in your inbox on Friday lunchtime through Substack. If you already subscribe to Substack emails, subscribe to this one as well. Only one a week, and it's full, overflowing with hot takes, isn't it, Terry?
It is. We only do one a week, but my God, there's so much. And so many talented writers.
Yes.
You know, participating in that too as well. So do please get yourself involved in our box set. It is fantastic, a fantastic read and a great primer for the beginning of the weekend.
Yes, the seven games you should be watching from Friday to Sunday. But that's all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry DeFellin, it's goodbye.
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 Get in touch with us on Blue Sky or Instagram, where we are at Sound of Football, or go to sofpodcast.com. Like us, share us, rate us and review us. Do it now!
I was going to say, Xabi Alonso is pretty beautiful.
He's a beautiful looking guy, yeah, there's no doubt about that.
Should we just talk about how beautiful coaches are instead?
Aren't they good? To be fair, they're all young and cool, aren't they?
Young and beautiful. Well, coaches are so beautiful now. Like, were the coaches, like, back in the day, they were all, like, old and grizzled and...
Yeah, they wore Arthur Daly sheepskin coats, yeah, and lots of gold.
It's the working class
background. And now they wear tight-fitting roll necks and white trainers. God, they're so good-looking.